Hello and welcome everyone to this week's edition of the Access Hour, an hour on our schedule every week dedicated to you, the community. This is your chance to come into the studio and make some media that matters. My name is Justin Mogg. I'm your volunteer host for this week. And on this week's edition, we listen back to the 12th annual Anne Braden Memorial Lecture, which took place on November 1st in the University of Louisville Strickler Hall Middleton Auditorium. On that evening, a packed house turned up to hear the following lecture by Dr. Kianga Yamahata Taylor, professor of African American Studies at Princeton University and author of From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation, which came out in 2016. The book surveys the historical and contemporary ravages of racism and persistence of structural inequality while connecting anti-police brutality protests with larger anti-capitalist movements. Dr. Taylor received national attention in 2016 when she was forced to cancel speeches in Washington and California due to violent threats from the right wing after referring to Donald Trump as a racist, sexist, megalomaniac in a commencement speech at Hampshire College. Her insight and voice are more vital than ever in today's political climate, and we were honored to host her visit to Louisville back on November 1st. And here she is with the Anne Braden Memorial Lecture. And Forward Radio was there.
How's everybody doing? I just want to start by thanking the organizers of today's event. It is truly an honor to be invited to deliver the Anne Braden Lecture. As always, I offer my comments in the spirit of provocation. I say that not only to people who assume they will disagree with me, but most importantly, I say it especially to people who assume they will agree with me. More to the point, I thank everyone for coming out today to hear what I have to say. Next week will mark the 2-year anniversary of the Trump presidency. It has been as bad as many of us thought it would be. It may be even safe to say that Trump is worse than what many of us could have imagined. The ramp up to next week's midterm election is a microcosm of the way that bigotry and scapegoating have shaped this administration's agenda. But as others have said today, and I probably do not need to tell anyone here this, 1 week ago yesterday, Gregory Bush walked into a grocery store and shot Maurice Steller as his grandson stood at his side watching in horror. When Bush left the store, he then shot and killed Vicki Lee Jones. These two people, who survived the racism and brutality of Jim Crow apartheid, were murdered by a white man not living in the past, but a brutal product of the world we live in today. And while local police in Jefferson Town took their sweet time in investigating these murders as hate crimes, any thinking person understood that Bush murdered Maurice Steller and Vicki Lee Jones because they were black. We know that before he came upon the Kroger, he tried to enter First Baptist Church in hopes of finding black congregants to cut down. What we didn't know is that by the end of a week that started so horribly, with bombs being sent to supposed enemies of Trump, only to be interrupted by the murders of Maurice Steller and Vicki Lee Jones, that it would reach its end with the white supremacist murdering 11 people while screaming, "All Jews must die." Donald Trump may not have pulled the trigger in either case, but in word and in deed, from separating black and brown children at the nation's border, only to imprison them in detention camps along the border, allowing the premature death of more than 3,000 Puerto Rican citizens, to his description of various African and Latin American nations as, quote, "sh-hole countries," to his inability to simply condemn the neo-Nazis and fascists who rampaged and murdered in Charlottesville, to his disgusting descriptions of Mexicans and immigrant rights, trans equality, asylum for refugees, abortion rights, combined with anti-Muslim hatred, meshes seamlessly with the politics of the alt-right and white supremacists, all of whom believe these issues represent what they refer to as white genocide. The brazen racism of the Trump administration and the Republican Party he leads has activated what was once a racist fringe of neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and white nationalists. But in doing so, Trump and the Republicans have pulled the ideas of white races from the margins of society into the center of government and policymaking. It is not hyperbole to say that white supremacy operates at the heart of this administration and the party that leads it. This has given the far right confidence that they are organizing, and so they are organizing more openly and more violently as a result, the seriousness of which can be measured by the weight of the bodies left in their wake. In the 10 largest cities in the United States, hate crimes are on the rise. The Southern Poverty Law Center has charted the growth of white supremacist organizations over the last 2 years. These dueling phenomena, Trump's rise to the White House and the mainstreaming of white supremacist ideas, has come quickly on the heels of the nation's first black president and the eruption of protests in Ferguson, Missouri, that quickly gave way to a national movement calling itself Black Lives Matter. The heroism of young black people in Ferguson and St. Louis in their rebellion against police abuse in black communities stood up against and their stand against institutional racism of the political status quo in both city and suburb. The rebellion stood as an important symbol and example for young black people across the country. They unleashed a pent-up rage demanding an end to police violence, abuse, and terror. They rebelled for their generation, the Obama generation, young black people who had believed in the slogan, "Yes, we can," who had voted like they had never voted before, but who had also grown tired and weary of cheap campaign slogans, paternalistic scolding, and a lightweight political agenda that did next to nothing to restore the enormous losses incurred through the financial crisis of 2008. With big expectations from the first black president came big disappointment at the failure to deliver. But young people didn't just complain, as many erroneously accused them of doing so. They rebelled, they marched, they organized, they emphatically declared Black Lives Matter. And the first sustained social movement against racism in the United States since the end of the black radicalization of the 1960s unfolded before our eyes. It is easy to forget the heroism of the Ferguson protests and the enormous sense of solidarity they generated. There was a feeling that they were fighting for all of us when they refused to submit to the authoritarianism and brutality of area police forces. But they also generated enormous pride when they refused to acquiesce to the chorus of liberal and Democratic Party operatives who told them to get off the streets. It is easy to forget the wave of protests that overtook this country in late November and December of 2014, when grand juries in Ferguson and Staten Island, New York, refused to indict the police officers that murdered Michael Brown Jr. and Eric Garner. Those protests transformed the local movement in Ferguson into a national movement united around the demand that Black Lives Matter. Tens of thousands of people across the country participated in acts of nonviolent civil disobedience. Lawyers, doctors, college students, high school students, nurses, ordinary people. On December 13, 2014, 50,000 people marched through the streets of New York with chants that connected Ferguson to New York City to the nation. Hands up, don't shoot. I can't breathe. Black Lives Matter. On that same weekend in Washington, D.C., in December of 2014, more than 100,000 people gathered to protest unrepentant police murder. There were protests across the nation in Baltimore Rebellion in April of 2015. Of course, these things are easy to forget when people feel as if the walls of this country are closing in. It's not just the white supremacy of the White House, but if the objective of the Black Lives Matter movement was the reformation of the nation's racist and regressive criminal justice system, then the ascendance of Jeff Sessions, a ghoulish neo-Confederate who recognizes his singular opportunity to use the power of his office, including the courts, the police, the law itself, to turn the clock back towards an unrelenting reliance on punishment to discipline and isolate the poor, the black, and brown, the working class, then surely this also represents a step backwards. Sessions has led the Trump administration's efforts to reverse any and every semblance of criminal justice reform that the movement had sought out over the previous 5 years. At least as it pertains to federal crimes and the federal judiciary, Sessions has pledged to seek the harshest punishment, to ease or completely withdraw federal supervision of local police forces, and to generally pursue a regressive agenda of law and order practices that until recently had been discredited. More directly, the police continue to maim and murder. From the tasing of an 11-year-old black girl in a Cincinnati grocery store accused of shoplifting, to the brutal murder of Botham Jean in Dallas, Texas, in his own home by an off-duty police officer, police across the United States continue to operate as a force of repression, unbound by law and empowered with a license to kill, harass, and intimidate African-Americans anytime, anywhere, and under any circumstance. What happened? How did we go from Black Lives Matter and a black president to the rise of a white supremacist president and the emergence of a white supremacist movement? Is there still a Black Lives Matter movement? And what does that mean for fighting racism today? And how does the movement open the possibility for a broader movement that seeks to end racism altogether? The point of this talk is to engage with these questions by looking at the past and what it means for our contemporary moment. Black Lives Matter forced the United States to face and confront the way that its criminal justice system was literally destroying black families and black lives in this country. In doing so, an even bigger question was opened about what made black people disproportionately vulnerable to policing in the first place. The compounding and intersecting realities of race and class repeatedly put African Americans in the crosshairs of the nation's police. In other words, black people suffered disproportionately from poverty and inequality because of racism and discrimination, meaning that race and class are inextricably linked in black America. Police brutality was not new in the lives of African Americans. It had been a permanent feature of black life since the end of the Civil War. Its significance became even more pronounced as African Americans became an urban population over the course of the 20th century, and it has frequently been resisted. As early as 1951, civil rights activists raised the slogan, "We charge genocide," to describe the complicity of the state with the murder of black citizens by the state's police. They presented a petition to the United Nations in 1956 that read in part, quote, the group, a group of activists presented this petition that they called "We Charge Genocide." It read in part, quote, "Once the classic method of lynching was the rope, now it is the policeman's bullet. To many an American, the police are the government, certainly its most visible representative. We submit that the evidence suggests that the killing of Negroes has become police policy in the United States, and that police policy is the most practical expression of government policy. Black Lives Matter not only raised consciousness about the perils of police abuse and violence, but it did so within the context of the rise of a black elite and black political class. It did so in the midst of the second term of the nation's first black president. This was important because it exemplified how much had changed in black life since the previous period of black mobilization and movement in the 1960s and 70s. Black Lives Matter was only the latest iteration of activism and organizing against racist police violence. But this movement was different as it emerged in the midst of the Obama administration, which shattered the public discussion that the United States was moving beyond its racist past into an era of post-racial understanding. It is easy to laugh off such ideas today, the idea that the United States would be entering into a post-racial period. But one cannot underestimate the appeal and power of this idea when Obama took office. December of 2008, Forbes magazine ran an enthusiastic editorial that claimed, quote, "Racism in America is over." In August 2009, the New York Times asked if the nation had reached, quote, "the end of black politics." The delusion of racial stability is what could lead the mainstream media to entertain the idea that we were entering a post-racial era. It is also why the establishment was so completely shocked when Ferguson and then Baltimore happened. The delusion of stability in racial politics came with the absence of sustained anti-racist struggle. Through the roughly 20-year period from the Los Angeles uprising in 1992 to the Ferguson uprising in 2014. Indeed, these years were marked by the ascendancy of liberal law and order and liberal anti-welfare politics led by Bill Clinton and the Democratic Party. The implication of these policies meant that poor and working-class African Americans were disappeared into prisons and the so-called criminal justice system, or were simply rendered disposable by racist and punitive welfare reform laws. In both cases, law and order and anti-poverty politics helped to generate a racist political discourse that reinforced the existing perception that black people were to blame for the inequality experienced in black communities. Simply blaming black people for the conditions of poverty in black communities helped to rationalize the Democratic Party's further drift away from what Bill Clinton had described as big government. After all, when you describe young black people as, quote, "not sharing our values," or, quote, "growing up in a culture alien from ours," as Bill Clinton did in the aftermath of the Los Angeles Rebellion, then you are reinforcing the idea that these are issues that cannot be fixed by public policy. When you describe young black people as, quote, "super predators," as Hillary Clinton did in 1996, you are essentially saying that those children were intrinsically, naturally criminal, and thus fit for imprisonment. Bill Clinton preached prisons, punishment, and the market as the only meaningful solutions to the crisis of poverty and inequality in black America. But because it was the Democratic Party championing these policies, their lasting and destructive impact were underreported, lightly discussed, or tacitly ignored. The consolidation of the Democratic Party around the leadership of Bill and Hillary Clinton, including the absorption of the Congressional Black Caucus, foreclosed the one conduit through which black grievances could flow in formal politics. Compounding this problem was that the never-ending effort to maintain control of Congress or to capture the presidency required ignoring or distorting the particular harm of policies of the Democratic Party in the lives of black people. As the Democrats attempted to capture the constituency of the Republican Party, the so-called suburban swing voter, the party was loath to discuss issues of central importance to black voters, including the expansion of public services and investment in public institutions, comprehensive anti-poverty policies, and beyond. In 2000 and again in 2004, the attempts to reclaim the presidency from George W. Bush and the Republicans required marginalizing or ignoring the grievances of black people. For the Democratic Party in the early 2000s, appealing to centrist Republicans disenchanted with the recklessness of George W. Bush required ignoring the persisting problems of inequality, discrimination, and abusive policing. This political strategy was aided and abetted by the black political class, who look to preserve their own rule in both local and national politics by also understating the social and economic crises pervasive across Black communities. The absence of discussion about these conditions effectively rendered the vast majority of working class and poor African Americans invisible in the United States. The invisibility of Black people and the illegibility of Black struggle were violently wrenched open to the light of day when Hurricane Katrina struck New Orleans in 2005. The world stood in shock, not only because of the bungling antics of the Bush administration in the rescue and relief phase of Katrina, but at the conditions the hurricane exposed. As actor Danny Glover would put it, quote, "The hurricane did not turn the region into a third world country. It revealed one." Bush was forced to admit that racism underpinned the poverty of the hundreds of thousands of African Americans displaced by the hurricane. In a nationally televised speech, Bush said, quote, "As all of us saw on television, there is some deep, persistent poverty in this region. And that poverty has roots in a history of racial discrimination, which cut off generations from the opportunity of America." Close quote. The disaster and resulting outcry lifted the veneer of what some call the greatest country on earth. It was the Obama candidacy and then presidency that finally opened a much wider discussion about the conditions of 21st century African-American life. Obama, operating in the shadow of Katrina, deftly combined an assessment of structural inequality with more typical discussions about Black culture, families, and personal responsibility. Obama could breathe new life into old stereotypes about Black men not fathering their children, or, quote, "too many men act like boys," in ways that no white politician could ever get away with. But his famous Philadelphia speech on race in March of 2008 showed that he could also discuss the legacy of federal housing discrimination and its role in segregating African Americans from the benefits of American society. Obama's political framing was not opportunistic in the sense that he invoked it only to appeal cynically to voters. But his strained effort to explain Black inequality as a combination of structural and self-induced behavioral limitations fit with the politics of the Black political class. It also resonated with the strain of political thought in Black communities that blamed Black families as well as structural inequality for Black hardship. This was hardly surprising given the mainstream insistence that Black culture was at the root of the issues confronting Black America. If this is the single resounding refrain heard since the collapse of the Black insurgency of the 1970s, it should not be shocking when many Black people also believe and say this to be the case. But even these insufficient explanations marked a break with the past by indicating some interest in Black life. Obama's candidacy sparked unprecedented interest in Black life outside of some kind of social calamity. This, in combination with a well-coordinated campaign, tapped into the anger and deep desire for change from the disastrous Bush years, which by its end included not only the Katrina catastrophe, but the 2008 financial crisis, where Black families bore the brunt of the foreclosure and jobs crisis. Obama's campaign seemed like an opportunity to repair the damage created by these twin phenomena. His rise to the presidency fueled the expectations of African American desires for change in their neighborhoods and daily life. But Obama's presidency quickly reflected more continuity than change. His inexhaustible search for the middle ground undermines his credibility among young Black people who were in search for someone who would champion their cause. Among Black elected officials who for years had been ineffective because of their efforts to curry favor with the National Democratic Party, who looked to secure their insider position by not raising the grievances of working class and poor African Americans, having finally captured the White House, the rise of Obama rendered them virtually silent. And even when members of the Congressional Black Caucus were willing to speak about the deteriorating economic condition of black communities, they could not do much more than point out inequality while not actually being prepared to do anything about it. For many black people, the painful reality of the political moment was shockingly clear. Even with more black elected officials in political office than at any other point in the nation's history, they were unable to transform the conditions besieging black America. In many cases, they were unwilling to even speak about it. The benign response to the economic crisis in black communities reinforced the point. As some will know, but many probably do not, 10 years ago in 2008, the American economy was in freefall. African Americans would bear the brunt of the Great Recession and the economic crisis that ensued. By its end, more than 240,000 black homeowners lost their homes. By the fall of 2009, black unemployment had reached a high of 15%, fueled by cuts to federal and state government jobs that had always been a bedrock for black employment. Walmart would become the largest employer of black Americans, supplanting the historic role of work in the U.S. Postal Service. The net worth of black families fell to $11,000 compared to $141,000 for white families. And an alarming 40% of black families had zero or negative wealth. As was the case in local, city, and state politics, where there had been black representatives for decades, their inability to produce actual legislative relief for black constituencies often led African-American elected officials to engage in the same kind of racist stereotyping that elected white officials of another period were prone to do. For example, in Philadelphia in 2011, African-American Mayor John Street, at a press conference in the city, while proclaiming that young black men had, quote, damaged your own race, launched into a tirade, speaking for many in the black political class. He said, quote, take those darn hoodies down, especially in the summer. Pull up your pants and buy a belt, because no one wants to see your underwear or your butt, close quote. Predictably, a year after Nutter's rant, he presided over the second largest school closure in American history when Philadelphia shuttered, closed down, forever closed 26 public schools. There are multiple examples of this dynamic. Black Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake of Baltimore, at one point prior to the uprising in Baltimore, said, quote, too many of us in the black community have become complacent about black-on-black crime. While many of us are willing to march and protest and become active in the face of police misconduct, many of us turn a blind eye when it's us killing us. When Baltimore exploded in rebellion against police racism and violence, she and Obama both referred to young blacks in Baltimore who participated in the rebellion as, quote, thugs and criminals. Two words that were never used by white officials in Ferguson. In other words, often, black elected officials help to narrate the experience of African Americans in ways that white elected officials could never get away with. By blaming blacks through rhetoric that emphasizes culture and morality and irresponsibility as the source of black inequality, as opposed to racism, discrimination, and economic inequality.
And we are listening back here on the Access Hour to the November 1st, 12th Annual Anne Braden Memorial Lecture, which took place at the University of Louisville's Strickler Hall Middleton Auditorium. Speaking to a packed house was Dr. Kianga Yamata Taylor, professor of African American Studies at Princeton University and author of From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. We return you now to Strickler Hall on the U of L campus for the 12th Annual Anne Braden Memorial Lecture here on the Access Hour on Forward Radio.
Black communities were the making of black communities, and that was really what was really necessary was personal transformation more than social policy. This was the toxic atmosphere that Black Lives Matter emerged within, or in the case destroyed by 20 years of law and order and racist scapegoating by those who claimed to represent them, finally exploded. Without a political outlet, political and social grievances build as if in a pressure cooker until they do boil over. It has been 4 years since the onset of the Black Lives Matter movement. While the movement helped to open a discussion about police violence in this country and even wrench hard-won changes in policing in some places, the problems exposed by Black Lives Matter are just as entrenched today as they ever have been. This has raised real questions among activists, but the wider public as well. But how can we win real change? Not just expose the conditions of inequality and abuse, but change the conditions of racism, inequality that is often hemmed in by police abuse and violence. For many within the movement, they have turned their attention to election season. In some ways, the pivot could be framed as moving from what Bayard Rustin used to say, from protest to politics, which for some reason is always held up as a more mature and reasonable route to getting the change that you desire. Indeed, in a September speech given by former President Barack Obama, he claimed that the most important form of protest that one can engage in is exercising one's right to vote. It is one variation of the theme from protest to politics. The Black Lives Matter movement had repeatedly been chastised for supposedly not having an agenda. In reality, the real problem was that much of the movement had objectives that were not in sync with the political status quo, including objectives like the abolition of police, prisons, and a massive redistribution of wealth and resources from the rich to the working class. This was the real problem with the movement for the Democratic Party and their liberal supporters. When in October 2016, a month before the presidential election, a Black Lives Matter activist in Chicago rejected an invitation from the Obama administration to attend a closed-door meeting. Obama personally denounced her as not being serious about reform. Obama said of Asleen Pulley from the Chicago Black Lives Matter chapter, quote, "The value of social movements and activism is to get you at the table, get you in the room, and then start trying to figure out how is this problem going to be solved. You then have a responsibility to prepare an agenda that is achievable, that can institutionalize the changes you seek and to engage the other side." Activist Brittany Packnett, instead of defending the autonomy of Pulley or the simple idea that the most powerful elected official in the world does not get to dictate the strategy of a social movement, instead backed up the president. She said, quote, "We can utilize so many tactics. Protest is incredibly important. Policy is incredibly important. It was important that there were real protesters in the room today and that this White House has continued to engage with protesters and activists across the country." This was a striking example of how the delusion of access or proximity to power works to move people out of the streets into what seems more real, tangible, a real or tangible way to address a problem or grievance. It feeds the idea that what we actually need are sympathetic political actors who argue on our behalf within government. Of course, some officials, elected officials, can be more sympathetic than others. But when they are all invested in maintaining the status quo and preserving the economic and political hierarchy that is the infrastructure of our society, it perpetuates cynicism and disappointment in mainstream politics. This is especially true when ordinary people feel left out and left behind. This is why 108 million people didn't vote in the last presidential election. Not because they are lazy or they just don't care about what happens in this country, but because it is hard to believe that when a billionaire is running against a millionaire, they either have your best interest at heart. There is a fundamental crisis in American politics. The growing gap between a government made up of elites, while the living standards of those they claim to represent continue to deteriorate. It is unsustainable. This is not cynicism. This is coming to grips with the reality that the average wealth of a United States senator is $3 million. Stacey Adams, and most famously, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, have put these policies as the core feature of their political platforms. And as a positive development, as positive a development as this is, and as an important role Bernie Sanders has played in opening up the space to seriously discuss these issues within formal politics, we cannot assume that the development of a left or progressive current within the Democratic Party is in the position to deliver significant political reforms without massive political pressure in the form of a social movement being exerted. This is what is potentially concerning about the move from protest to politics, that many organizations connected to the Black Lives Matter movement are currently engaged with. I certainly understand the pressures to do so in Trump's America, where neo-Confederates and other white racists are running on racism. But the term to electoral politics overlooks how the Black Lives Matter rebellion and the dynamic of struggle and protest upended all of American politics and put Black lives at the center of national politics. More than lobbying, more than backroom meetings, and proximity to power, it was struggle that had the potential to transform the political situation. And it is the retreat from struggle, the retreat from the mass movement in the streets, which threatens to move Black issues back into the quiet corners of our society. And the retreat of the anti-racist movement is not just a problem for Black people or others directly affected by racial oppression. It hurts the entire struggle against inequality in our society. And as more ordinary white people become visible markers of the failure of capitalism, we see that conservatives increasingly blame white poverty and social crises, most notably drug addiction, on a morality crisis. In Charles Murray's book, Coming Apart, The State of White America, he blamed declines in white working class living standards on high divorce rates, out of wedlock births, dwindling church attendance, and men who can't hold jobs. Sounds familiar. Murray, of course, became infamous by insisting that disproportionate rates of poverty in Black working class communities were because of biological differences between whites and blacks. He rehashes these ideas to analyze white poverty and concludes that low IQ and biology are factors. But now, instead of being between blacks and whites, the biological differences are now between rich and poor white people. The much louder but underwhelming hillbilly elegy also argues that white Appalachian poverty is driven by poor choices, behavior, and morality, and not material deprivation. But perhaps the most succinct contempt for poor and working-class white people came from an article published in the Republican Conservative Right-Wing National Review. I will quote at length. If you spend time in hard-scrabble white upstate New York and eastern Kentucky, or my own native West Texas, and you take an honest look at the welfare dependency, the drug and alcohol addiction, the family anarchy, which is to say, the whelping of human children, with all the respect and wisdom of a stray dog, you will come to an awful realization. It wasn't Beijing. It wasn't even Washington, as bad as Washington can be. Nothing happened to them. There wasn't some awful disaster. There wasn't a war or a famine or a plague or a foreign occupation. Even the economic changes of the past few decades do very little to explain the dysfunction and negligence and the incomparable malice of poor white America. The truth about these dysfunctional, downscale communities is that they deserve to die. Economically, they are negative assets. Morally, they are indefensible. The white American underclass is enthralled to a vicious, selfish culture whose main products are misery and used heroin needles. Donald Trump's speeches make them feel good. So does Oxycontin. Of course, liberals don't provide a credible alternative to this unique American cruelty when they parrot the same contempt by reducing the experiences of to privilege in ways that do not resemble and certainly do not make sense of the actual experiences of working class white people. There are 20 million poor white people in this country. The imprisonment of white women is surging, according to recent reports, because of growing alcohol abuse and drug addiction. Life expectancy for ordinary white women has reversed. This means they are not living longer. They are dying earlier. The reversal of life expectancy is unheard of in the developed world. Life in poor and working class enclaves is increasingly defined by economic insecurity, alcoholism, opioid addiction, and suicide. And while it is important to point out how elected officials are very willing to paint a sympathetic picture of opioid addiction as a healthcare issue and not a criminal issue, as they did with the crack phenomenon in the 1980s and 1990s, because opioids are perceived to affect white people and crack was perceived to only affect black people, I would caution against believing all of the rhetoric that opioid addicts are getting loving care and attention from the federal government. For example, in Middletown, Ohio, a town of 50,000 people that is 87% white and where 532 people died of opioid overdoses last year, a person on the city council has proposed that drug addicts get two opportunities for medical intervention in the event of an overdose. But if there is a third call for an ambulance or medical treatment because of an overdose, there should be no response. The councilman says that the drug is too expensive at $36 a dosage. This is not white privilege. This is capitalism in its most savage form. Of redistribution or politically restructuring or what King called the radical reconstruction of the United States. The Black Lives Matter movement has shown us most recently how a mass movement can bring the marginalized, the oppressed, the invisible, and often the disposable into the center of political life. But the movement has not gone nearly far enough. It means that there is still work to do in creating the kinds of democratic organizations that allow for the greatest number of people to participate and be active in a movement. The greatest number of people whose lives are ruined by violent and abusive policing to have a say in how we should confront that system. And that kind of organizing must also make itself known in the streets. To change the kinds of policies and practices that Black Lives Matter has set out to do, we need more than heroic acts on the parts of individuals or small groups of people. We need mass action, and that has to be built up from the grassroots. These are much larger issues that cannot be solved in the next election or the one after. Of course, people feel a great urgency to deliver a blow to Trump and to disempower the Republican Party. But we must also grapple with the reality that elections alone cannot solve the deep problems of alienation, deprivation, and inequality in this country. This isn't a gratuitous attack on elected officials as universally unreliable. But without social movement pressure, the countervailing pressures of pragmatism, compromise, and negotiation neuter the possibility of change. It's not just a theoretical argument. It is one that has been borne out in history as well. It is how we can make sense of the transformation of Black politics over the last 50 years. The Black movements of the 1960s created the conditions for the rise of the Black political class, including members of Congress, mayors, and a range of state and local officials. In 1969, the Congressional Black Caucus formed among the 13 Black members of Congress. They described themselves as the conscience of the Congress when they formed out of the crucible of the Black insurgency of the 1960s. But by 1986, members of the CBC would go on to co-sponsor Ronald Reagan's Anti-Drug Act, which declared the war on drugs. And by 1994, most of the CBC would go on to vote in support of Bill Clinton's racist crime bill. What happened? Without the movement pushing these political actors forward or holding them to account for their political positions, it was too easy to get captured by the moderating process of governing. And in that process of governing, compromise and negotiation are paramount. And that almost always means that the things that are important to us are put on hold or left behind altogether. The failure of the Democratic Party to adequately address the material deprivation at the root in Black communities, in combination with the party's adaptation to the politics of racial resentment and racial grievance of the Republican Party, combined to undermine and subvert the kinds of independent Black political activity that gave rise to opening the possibility for them to exist in formal Black politics in the first place. But the critique of electoral politics is about so much more than the next election, or even the point of why we build and participate in social movements. We have to consider the way that electoral projects almost always constrain our ability to think beyond reforms and that which is immediately possible. Indeed, the framework of from protest to politics embodies the core of American liberal thought, the assumption that the existing governing bodies and institutions of the United States are capable of creating or ensuring equality and opportunity for Black people or any of the oppressed. The entire 20th century refutes that premise, and while it remains seductive in ways that the revolutionary transformation of the United States seems impossible. But the transformative power of the social movement is not only about its coercive influence in policymaking or the governing institutions of our country, but we must also consider administration. For them, the numbers cease to be numbers and become the evidence of their senses, the conclusions of their imagination. The larger the demonstration, the more powerful and immediate, visible, audible, tangible, a metaphor it becomes for the total collective strength. Black Lives Matter is an entry point into the examination of a society that locks people into perpetual poverty and inequality, and then cages and ruthlessly punishes them when they dare to challenge or reject their condition. Social movements can certainly challenge the method of policing, the conditions that make black people vulnerable to policing, and they can even get some method of policing or incarceration to stop. But in our efforts to reduce the harm created by this system, we must also begin to ask the bigger questions of why this society needs police and prisons in the first place. We may ask why non-payment of rent is against the law, but homelessness is not. We may ask why shoplifting food is a crime, but hunger is not. We may ask, as King once did, why we must pay water bills in a world that is two-thirds water. Simple questions can lead to bigger questions of who even made these laws, and to whom does the law serve, and to whom does the law protect. The crisis we face are problems of the market, meaning they are permanent features of our society. Misery means profit. Hunger means profit. Disease means profit. Addiction means profit. Prisons mean profit. Racism means profit. Capitalism is killing our planet. It is destroying the lives of millions of people in this country, on this planet today. It is destroying our future. Capitalism was founded and perpetuated on the brutal subjugation of indigenous people, the enslavement of black people, and the violent expropriation of tens of millions of immigrants. As Malcolm X once said, you cannot have capitalism without racism, and you cannot have racism without capitalism. The best of the black radical tradition has always understood that black liberation, the notion that black people can live free of physical, economic, and social coercion, cannot be achieved within the existing system. Simply put, we cannot vote or even protest our way into ending racism in a society where racial inequality and injustice is so tightly wound into the marrow of its bones that there is literally no period of time in its entire existence where black oppression was not a key feature. And while it is true that there are better or worse elected officials, what can never be forgotten is that in the constant weighing of who or what party is the greater or lesser evil, we never engage with the larger issue of how we get free. Our day-to-day struggle ensues to make life livable today. So this isn't a recipe for sitting around until some more large and profound struggle comes along. We have to fight to make life livable today. But we must also cling to a larger vision of what a different world could look like. As Anne Gray reminded us, quote, in every age, no matter how cruel the oppression carried on by those in power, there have been those who struggled for a different world. I believe this is the genius of humankind, the thing that makes us half divine, the fact that some human beings can envision a world that has never existed. Another world is possible, but we are the only ones who can create it. No one is coming to save us. We must join together to save ourselves. Thank you.
And that concluded the 12th annual Anne Braden Memorial Lecture at the University of Louisville. This year, given on November 1st by Dr. Kianga Yamata Taylor, professor of African American Studies at Princeton University and author of From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. This annual lecture is hosted by the University of Louisville's Anne Braden Institute for Social Justice Research, and you can learn more at louisville.edu/Braden. You've been listening to the Access Hour here on Forward Radio 106.5 FM. Stay tuned to Forward Radio. Lots of great stuff coming up, and we'll be back in your ears again next week.